So the next case, which is also one that's somewhat contradictory to another case we're going to discuss today, is when is an address alone or otherwise imperfect property description sufficient for the statute of frauds? And the statute of frauds basically just says that you have to have a description of the property sufficient so that a person who's not familiar with the area could identify the property without any, with specificity and without any confusion. And in this case, there was a contract that contained a series of addresses, and then it contained this phrase, plus or minus 81.50 acres, I guess, AC, of AO6A1, da-da-da-da. And it contained a legal exhibit that had the same verbiage, and then it had said referenced a survey that was not completed yet. So the question is that sufficient? Well, I think, first of all, your plus or minus doesn't really help, especially if you don't have a survey. They had a series of addresses. Well, we're going to talk about a case later where just an address is sufficient. But in this case, I think you have this combination of the plus or minus series of addresses and such a large amount of acreage that you just didn't have enough specificity. This was not sufficient. The next case here, the address is going to be found to be sufficient. So in this case, Sanchez v. Berrigan. Sanchez and Berrigan entered into a written agreement for Berrigan to buy property. Between 2009 and 2014, Berrigan paid Sanchez $20,000 or $52,000. And after the final payment, Sanchez refused to tender the deed, and he made two arguments. One is that there was a typo, that the property was listed as 2023 T.O. Dick instead of T.O. Dink, and the other is that there was no property description. So he said, well, there's no property description, and the address is wrong, so therefore, I'm not obligated to sell him the property. And the court was like, well, I think your argument's kind of weak. They basically said that. And then they said, but anyway, we're going to let parole evidence in, and we're going to have, let other people explain the intent of the parties. Now, generally, parole evidence cannot be used to establish fundamental concepts and fundamental framework portions of a contract. However, in this case, because we're really talking about clarifying a typographical error, and we're really talking about the party's intent, what I'm trying to say is we're trying to construe the intent and not trying to provide new intentions into an already written agreement. So details which merely explain or clarify essential terms will generally be allowed by parole evidence. The trial court issued summary judgment in favor of Berrigan. The Court of Appeals affirmed. And again, in this case, an address alone was sufficient. But again, I would also point out that I believe it was a residential address, so it was a very simple, small piece of property that could easily be identified by its residential address. This next case, I think, is probably one of the only very important cases that we had this year, and it has to do with consequential damages and what constitutes consequential damages, and it's a Texas Supreme Court case, so we should all pay attention to what they have to say here, because I actually have been spending a lot of time arguing in my practice with people about what are or not consequential damages when you go through the indemnity section, and everybody wants to exclude consequential damages. So I've been spending a lot of time on this, so I found this case to be informative. In this case, Signature Industrial Services contracted with International Paper to upgrade a piece of equipment. And this is where we all know this was going to go wrong to begin with. The parties agreed to initial cost plus a change order because the statement of work was not definitive, and Signature Industrial said that they couldn't give a fixed price because it just was not clear enough what the work was going to do, what it was going to end up to cost. We all know agreements to agree are always a bad idea. They never work out well in the end. So anyway, the parties disagreed at the end on how much the work was worth. International Paper refused to pay. And meanwhile, the plaintiffs suffered a series of misfortunes. One of the misfortunes was that they were in the middle of negotiations to sell their company to someone else. and the initial offer for $42 million got revoked and was replaced by a series of smaller offers. You also have the fact that the plaintiff was unable to pay their employment taxes, they were unable to pay their vendors, they suffered a reputational decline, and so they brought all this out in court as reason why they were entitled to consequential damages. The jury ended up holding that the defendant was liable not just for the $2.4 million in direct damages, which was the contract, what should have been the contract price, but that over 20 times that in consequential damages. And the consequential damages they upheld was the lost acquisition value from the original offer that had been on the table. Now, the problem with this is that nobody knew that acquisition offer was out there. It was private. So, the Court of Appeals then looked at the case, and they rejected it, and they said, no, nobody knew that was out there, but I'm going to give you the book value. I'm going to say, okay, the decline in your reputation, the decline in your book value, so it went down to $12 million, the consequential value damages that were awarded. But then the Supreme Court came in and said, no, you're both wrong. Consequential damages must be foreseeable and calculable with reasonable certainty.